At least by Apple time, it's after 9 o'clock. So. Anyway, we'll call to order EWD's Board of Directors meeting for June 5th, 2019, time being 9 a.m. Let's have the... Nick, can you lead us in the flag salute?
Please stand and join me in the flag salute.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, with that, this is a time and a place for anybody wishing to address the board for anything that's not on the agenda today. And seeing no hands raised or speaker cards, we will go to the public hearing. This is a time and a place set for a duly noticed public hearing regarding a proposed amended and restated rate and method of apportionment of special tax for Community Facilities District Number 2012-61, which is Autumn Winds, of Eastern Municipal Water District, and the intention to consider amending the improvements and authorized to be financed through the CFD to include the addition of certain park district improvements to be owned and operated by Valleywide Park and Recreation District. Notice of this public hearing has been published in accordance with the law. I declare this public hearing open and would ask for a staff report on this proposed action.
Good morning, President Sullivan, Directors of the Board. BMW has received a signed petition by KB Home Coastal Inc. requesting that the board consider an amended and restated rate and method of apportionment of special tax for CFD number 2012-61 Autumn Winds, and to consider approving the addition of park district improvements. KB Home Coastal Inc. is the sole landowner within the CFD. On April 17, 2019, the board adopted resolution number 2019-38, declaring its intention to consider an amendment to the rate and method of apportionment and to the facilities the CFD is authorized to finance to include park improvements. This amendment will increase the amount of special taxes within the CFD while maintaining the not-to-exceed amount of bonded indebtedness at $4 million. This increase in the special tax rates is supported by an increase in home prices since 2013 when the CFD was formed. A price point study verified comparable prices of homes in the surrounding area, which were used in setting the special tax in order to ensure compliance within BMWD's debt policy, notably maintaining a maximum effective rate of 2%. With the adoption of resolution number 2019-38, the board also approved a JCFA by and among BMWD, Valleywide Park and Recreation District, and KB Homes, which will serve to facilitate the financing of park improvements throughout the CFD. These park improvements will be owned and operated by Valleywide Park and Recreation District. This project is planned for 141 homes and is located east of Menifee in an unincorporated area of Riverside County, south of Olive, east of Leon, and west of Bryce. The board has received and reviewed a CFD report for the CFD prepared by Webb Municipal Finance, which is hereby entered into the record of this public hearing.
Okay, I would ask the Secretary of the Board how this hearing was noticed.
Notice of the public hearing was published on May 28, 2019 in the Press Enterprise, a newspaper circulated within the CFD boundary in accordance with the Mellow Ridge Community Facilities Act of 1982.
If the Secretary of Board has received any written protest to the proposals, I would ask her to provide copies thereof to the Board.
No written protests to the proposal have been received.
Thank you. At this time, are there any members of the public who wish to speak on this matter? If so, please come forward to the podium, state your name and address for the record, and present your comments. Seeing no further speakers, I hereby declare the public hearing closed. At this time, we are ready to approve the following resolutions. Resolution approving an amendment to the rate and method of apportionment for CFD 2012-61, adding certain authorized facilities and calling an election therein. I will accept a motion and a second to adopt the resolution.
I'll make that motion. Second.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries unanimously with Director Slauson absent. The resolution that we have just adopted authorizes the amended and restated rate and method of apportionment attached to the resolution number 2019-38, approves an amendment to the authorized facilities to include park improvements, and calls an election within CFD number 2012-61 to be held at this time by the Secretary.
All ballots have been cast in connection with the election for Community Facilities District number 2012-61, Autumn Winds, of Eastern Municipal Water District, and the election has now been closed. The result of said election, which includes the number of votes cast for and against Propositions A and B, was unanimous in favor of all propositions.
Having heard the statement of the Secretary certifying the results of the voting on this proposition, I will entertain a motion to adopt. Resolution certifying the results of the June 5th, 2019 election within CFD number 2012-61, Autumn Winds of Eastern Municipal Water District.
Move adoption.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries unanimously with Director Slauson absent. This concludes the public hearing. We will now return to the next item on the agenda. Okay, with that, we're going to jump down to agenda item 6A in favor of getting Mr. Coffey back to work in Los Angeles. So, Paul.
Thank you, President Sullivan, members of the board. Pleased to have today with us Brad Coffey, the group manager for the Water Resources Management Group at Metropolitan Water District of Southern California. Brad's going to give us an update today on Metropolitan's emergency storage program update. Just by background, Brad leads the Water Resource Management Group at Met, and their scope is really to look at long-term water supply, imported water resource programs, water use efficiency, and really doing long-term planning for drought and climate change. Brad's been with the district since 1990, served in operations group, and we've really had a chance to get to know Brad a lot better in his current role. And he's really done a great job and appreciate all the support he's given to Eastern. And we're really glad he could come out today and give us this presentation. So, Brad, please.
Thank you, Paul, President Sullivan, and members of the board. It's my pleasure to come before you and to talk about the emergency storage that Metropolitan maintains in the region in the event of a large earthquake or other emergency. So really our storage portfolio can be viewed in two parts. One is that water which we exercise in the reservoirs for dry years, and that which we reserve for emergencies. It's a little bit like an emergency supply fund that we all recommend that our children have in their bank accounts. And certainly any money that's in their bank accounts that's greater than the emergency supply fund is available in an emergency, and that's the same way it is for us. In looking at this graphic, this is one which may be familiar to you, but let me explain it. In all of the green bars, that is our dry year storage. That is water which is available whenever the demand for water is greater than the imported supply. And as you see, it's ranged from a low of around 0.9 million acre feet, 900,000 acre feet, up to as high as 2.7 million acre feet. And that's really what much of our focus has been on and what most people track. But we also are interested in this red or orange bars, which is the supply of water that we hold in the region for an emergency. And with the construction of Diamond Valley Lake, we were really able to advance the storage of regional water for this emergency. So our main emergency, the big one that we plan for, is a large earthquake on the San Andreas Fault system. And if you've ever read John McPhee's book, Soundland, California, you understand the the huge forces that are at play in the formation of what Southern California was. And so in this plan, we're assuming a large earthquake that's projected by the U.S. Geological Survey that would open up the fault from the San Andreas Fault, from Palm Beach at the Salton Sea, all the way to Gorman. And there would be about an 11.5-foot slip on that fault. Now, the fault isn't a very specific thin line, but it's really a region, kind of a braided cord of the fault. And that crosses all three of the major imported supply systems in Southern California. Now, I have an animation that may look like it's from a disaster movie, but this is the animation of energy coming through the region following this earthquake. So you'll see that the earthquake projection first breaks near the Salton Sea, and this wave of the rip goes northwestern across the LA region, and the higher colors, the different colors, just signify the energy that's emanating throughout the region. So this is a very unlikely scenario, but it's a very significant scenario. One of the other things that you'll see is in areas where there's lots of potential for soil liquefaction, that the energy just is contained in that area. And you can see that much of the LA Basin remains with significant shaking. This is, we're getting into this a little bit faster than real time, 2.5 minutes or 3 minutes into an earthquake. That would be a really long time. But this is the scenario that we're planning for. So Metropolitan, as well as Department of Water Resources and Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, have all looked at this scenario and what potential damages could result. For us, in terms of the imported supply, it's largely along the Colorado River Aqueduct. And in this area where the Colorado River Aqueduct crosses across the fault, it's really a rather complex geology. So we'll zoom in on this, and it's really amazing. If you read some of the old reports, some of the old engineering reports, they obviously knew about this fault. You can just see it just walking around out there. And what they decided to do was when they crossed the main fault, they would do two things. One, they would cross the fault at a right angle, so spend as little time along the main area of the fault, and they would bring the aqueduct up as shallow as possible. So two things that kind of minimize the exposure to damage from an earthquake. So let me describe to you the type of damage that our experts are projecting may happen if this earthquake were to occur. There are two things going on. One is a horizontal shift, that 11.5-foot shift. That's over a relatively small period and actually relatively easy to repair. We believe that that would take up to about 6 months to repair that. The other is much more insidious. It's a vertical lift. And in a gravity aqueduct, a vertical lift of 3 feet over 35 miles can be something pretty significant. However, that vertical lift will only reduce the capacity of the aqueduct by about 20%. So we believe that within 6 months, we can bring the aqueduct back online at about 80% of its capacity. And 80% of its capacity is about the expected dry year supply, or the normal year supply that we bring in on the Colorado River, around 900,000 acre feet. You'll see that the Colorado River aqueduct coming back into service is really what will supply the region following this earthquake. In fact, that's what supplied the region during the most recent drought. And a lot of what we learned during this most recent drought is what gives us confidence in being able to supply water to the region following an earthquake. Now, the Los Angeles Aqueduct expects damage to one of their major tunnels, the Elizabeth Tunnel. And again, an 11.5-foot offset. Remember, that's about the width of a freeway lane. So across the Cajon Pass, you're talking about a full shift of one lane of the freeway, and think of all the other infrastructure going through there, the rail, natural gas pipelines, fuel pipelines. Interestingly, one of the big concerns following this earthquake is actually gasoline in Las Vegas, because so much of the gasoline supply to Las Vegas is transported there by a pipeline through the Cone Pass. Los Angeles expects about an 18-month repair period before they get their system back online. So that affects deliveries from the West Branch. The California Aqueduct, I don't know if they didn't read our earlier engineering reports or it's just the nature, I think it's just the nature of the landscape there, but they didn't have the opportunity to just cross the fault in one at one right angle. In fact, they have to parallel the fault quite some time. So we're expecting probably more significant and longer to repair damage along the stretch of the East Branch, certainly, and also some damage on the West Branch. We're expecting up to 12 months to bring the West Branch into service and up to 24 months to completely repair the East Branch. So how does this interact with the Colorado River Aqueduct or with the Los Angeles Aqueduct? Basically, the West Branch also serves what the Los Angeles Aqueduct does. So once the West Branch is back into service, the city of Los Angeles can be served. And so, in essence, that reduces their outage period to 12 months. Because we take this philosophy of kind of the greatest good for the greatest number and bringing back water to the region. And then in the East Branch, through the drought, we learned how we can move water throughout our system, how we can serve the Mills plant from Diamond Valley Lake. Four of our five water treatment plants can be served from Diamond Valley Lake. And so in essence, we would turn the system around to look like it was a very, very dry year where we'd be moving Colorado River water throughout the region. So what is the emergency storage objective? And equally as important, what is it not? The way of thinking about it is it's a supply of water that we'll maintain in the region for just this emergency. We won't dip into it during a drought year, but it's also not overly specified. That is, we don't have a bunch of very rigid rules saying in each reservoir there shall be a minimum of a certain amount of water. We want the maximum flexibility for our normal operation, but also to be able to store this set volume of water. And the whole goal is to basically to prevent a severe water shortage to the region following the earthquake. That water would be the engine of growth and engine of rebuilding for the region, and that we wouldn't have major displacements as other regions might have seen. Importantly, this is not an allocation plan. This is not saying who gets what water or in which reservoir there's a reservation for any individual agency. So think of it as a planning objective for an amount of water that we store in the region. So this emergency storage objective depends on what our presumed outage is, how much retail demand cutback we would see, and in this example we're looking at basically a significant reduction in outdoor water use. What the remaining local supply production would be, and then that calculates how much water we would need in the local reservoirs. So for the outage period, our current assumption was simply 6 months, or our earlier assumption was 6 months on the three imported supply aqueducts. After these past years, we know a lot more about what the potential damage scenario will be, and it's between 6 months for the Colorado River Aqueduct, 24 months for the East Branch, 12 months for the West Branch, and 18 months for the LA Aqueduct. So just that in and of itself, you see that there's a growing need for an emergency supply. We now know more about what the damage would be and about what the repairs would need to be and how long those might take. I'm sorry. This was the outage period, and the retail demand cutback. So we also learned from the drought that agencies in a drought emergency could reduce 25 to 35%. Now we're concerned that as we go forward and as landscapes become more water efficient, that the ease of outdoor water use will be reduced. There'll be some demand hardening. So we'll be revisiting this objective probably about every 5 years with our integrated resource plan, because in that time frame we'll know a little bit more about how the demands have been hardening. But what we basically would expect is a cutback of about 25% to 35%, largely outdoor water use. And really you'd have all the advertisement you'd need to get that on the nightly news. This would be very visible. I'm sure we would have governor-declared emergencies, and I really believe that the region would understand that reducing outdoor water use would be necessary to preserve health and safety for the region. So our assumption is that we'd get in the 25 to 35% range of total water use reduction over this outage period. Now, local supply production, the current assumption was that there was 100% production of local supplies in the region. And in talking with many of our agencies, we felt that this was perhaps too optimistic of an evaluation. And we're now looking at, in aggregate, about 80 to 90% local production that would remain. Some agencies, like Orange County, Municipal Water District of Orange County, have done more extensive studies about what type of damage they would expect to local wells. And what they really expect to local groundwater production is damage in the above ground features, the connections of the well to the supply system, things that could be accessed relatively quickly, and they're not really expecting damage within the deep formation or that would render a well unusable. I would encourage us in this water district to think about that as well, and what potential losses of local supply we would see. And then our emergency storage capacity, the water in all of these local reservoirs, Diamond Valley Lake for sure, Lake Matthews for sure, but also all of the Department of Water Resources reservoirs, would be accessed in this emergency. So the volume of water is the sum of accessible water in all of these reservoirs that we see here. All of them are on this side of the San Andreas Fault. Now let me talk you through this table because there's a bunch of numbers on the table. So on the columns, you have the retail demand columns, we'll start with the number 1.42 million acre feet. That's in the upper left. So if we assumed that there was no cutback in retail demand, and if we assumed that 20% of the local resources would be lost during this outage period, we would need to be storing 1.4 million acre feet of water for this event. Now let's look at, let's call that a pessimistic outlook. If we looked at a very optimistic outlook, look at the number in the lower right. If we assumed that there would be a 50% reduction in the retail demand cutback and no loss of local supply, the region would only need to store 290,000 acre feet to get through that. So through talking with all of our agencies, through talking with kind of the best minds in geology and the water system operation, we have worked through a process where we've landed, not unsurprisingly, somewhere in the middle. That assumption is around 25% cutback of retail demand and around 90% of local supply production. And that leads to 750,000 acre feet, or an increase of 120,000 acre feet from our current emergency supply volume. Let me say one more thing about this, is that the retail demand cutback, it assumed that retail demands were, according to our integrated resources plan projections. As you may know, our integrated resources plan projection did not initially estimate the significant water savings that we've been seeing post-drought. And so the demand that is built into this assumption is higher than what we're currently seeing. So that gives us some comfort if we're thinking that maybe there's greater loss of local supply or if a retail demand cutback might be more difficult to attain. This is also why we're planning to update this following our next integrated resources plan, because we have much better numbers about local production and about expected retail demands. So in summary, we recommended an increase of about 120,000 acre feet for emergency storage. That changes it from 630,000 acre feet to 750,000 acre feet. And we'll begin accounting for that in this fall as we begin looking towards the 2020 water supply. So if one follows our accounting carefully of the water supply, you'll see probably in about October, November, a tick down in the dry year supply of 120,000 acre feet. And you might say, well, where did that water go? It's remaining in the region for the protection of the region's economy by reclassifying that dry year supply as wet year supply. And what do we think that that would look like? As you know, this is another wet year, and we're expecting to end the year with record amounts of dry year storage in the region. And of that record amount of dry year storage, a small portion of that storage will be reclassified as emergency. And this actually shows it on that scale. So you see the uptick of 120,000 acre feet, but also the rise in the dry air storage. So you see from 630,000 acre feet to 750,000 acre feet in a year that we're fortunate to be having gaining in the dry air supply. So that concludes my remarks, and I'd be happy to address any questions you may have regarding this study.
So this really says we don't really have much of an issue providing water for a 24-month outage. Is that what we're saying?
What I'm saying is that we now know that we can bring the Colorado River Aqueduct back up quicker than everything else, and that that can really serve the region, just as it served the region in the drought. And that would be, with the coordination between Department of Water Resources and the City of Los Angeles, this idea of the greatest good for the greatest number might mean that more crews are heading to the Colorado River Aqueduct early in the following the earthquake to get that on even quicker. But yes, we can get through a 24-month outage of the East Branch. Now, I will tell you that there are some areas along the Rialto Feeder that we don't have an alternate way of supplying water, and we're working on that. We recognize that there are certain spots in our system that Colorado River water doesn't flow to.
The exclusive areas.
In some of those exclusive areas, yes.
Ventura County also being.
Ventura County and the Rialto area.
Okay. Brad, I had a question and a comment. I think one of the things that has probably benefited this study was the operational scenarios which had to put in place during the drought, where the state water project yield was almost nothing, and the Colorado River Aqueduct really had to serve almost the entire district. Were those operational scenarios kind of central to the planning on this once the realization was made that the Colorado River Aqueduct is a facility that could be brought back on soonest and have the least risk?
Yes, absolutely. And there were our actual physical changes that we made to assure ourselves of being able to get Colorado River water up to the Mills plant, for example. There were other things that that our staff and just the creativity of our staff was able to bring to bear in terms of moving water through our system that had it not been for that drought where we kind of incrementally changed our system to achieve those things, we would have probably still remained out of our realm of expected operations. But yes, that 5% state water project allocation was kind of a drought earthquake for us that taught us how to move water robustly through the system.
Thank you.
Yeah, what's the time frame just to reverse the flow from Diamond Valley Lake back to Mills? Or get it back to Los Angeles?
I would expect that it would be within around 2 days.
Oh,
depending on where the breaks were and protecting against canal drawdown and the like, but within about 2 days we could have the system much turned around.
Incredible. Okay.
Yeah.
Great presentation.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thanks for coming up, Brad.
Sure. Yeah, thank you, Brad. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, we'll go to the executive reports.
Thank you. Good morning again, President Sullivan, members of the board. I appreciate the board members coming in early for the employee breakfast today. Director Slauson, you were missed. But we told your usual jokes in your absence. But no, thank you all for coming early. I know the employees appreciated that. I want to start out with some updates from the my weekly report last week. We've been working with the city of Hemet. They have two active potable production wells that are out of service due to some ongoing projects they're doing to rehabilitate one of the wells and re-equip the other well. We've been working with the city because as we get into the summer months, they want to make sure that they have enough redundancy and supply redundancy in their system to meet peak summer demands. And so Jeff and the operations group have been working with the city to essentially set up three additional emergency interties with the city. This came about over the last couple of weeks. So we've been coordinating with the city, looking at the hydraulics of their system, the peak day demands. And to date, I'm happy to report we have two of those interconnections up and running already. One is a 1,000 GPM connection at Stetson Avenue and Kirby Street in the Seven Hills area. And the second is a 500 GPM connection at the Buena Vista Street north of Fruitvale near Searle Park. We think there it does probably for to provide additional capacity need to be a third interconnection, so we're working on an additional site in the proximity of State Street and Chambers to put a 2,000 GPM interconnection, so that one has yet to be installed. And the city has also been coordinating with Lake Hemet, and they've constructed an additional interconnection for Lake Hemet. So we're going to continue to work with this. I think it's important that we support the city, and this is kind of what we do well as water agencies, is we work together when each of our various facilities are need some assistance. And so we'll make sure that the city has this water during emergencies during the summer season. And just want to report that we have two of the three connections already under construction and operational this week. Under past and ongoing activities, with respect to the potential annexation of the Fallbrook Public Utilities District and Rainbow into Eastern's wholesale service area, we continue to coordinate with the staff of those agencies. I met with the general managers last week. The agencies have initiated discussions with the San Diego County Water Authority, and are really looking at the operational, financial, and LAFCO requirements of the detachment. In addition, what we're working towards is preparation of a planning memorandum of understanding between Eastern, Fallbrook, and Rainbow. The idea of that would be to outline kind of our general conditions of how we would annex those entities as wholesale agencies, much in the same way that we currently serve the Rancho California Water District. But also in that MOU, it would outline the planning process, cost responsibilities, and other issues associated with potential litigation. They've also requested the two agencies that we initiate ad hoc committee meetings. So we have formed an ad hoc committee, and our first ad hoc committee meeting is scheduled for July 2nd. At that meeting, I intend to go over an outline of what would be in the MOU, and we will provide them the MOU at that time. The agency's detachment is now receiving a little bit of press. There was a Voice of San Diego article that I provided the link for in your report. This morning there was a Union Tribune article. So obviously this is getting some attention in the Water Authority service area. But it's interesting, I have been contacted by a number of people down there, and it's surprising how many of those agencies say, if you think about where Fallbrook and Rainbow are within San Diego system, and that they don't receive benefits from many of the reliability projects that the Water Authority has constructed or supplemental supplies, and they pay a very, very high markup on their met water, that it's not surprising that they would be looking to this in order to lower the cost to their customers. So we continue to report to the board on that, and we're looking forward to the meeting on July 2nd. Under groundwater replenishment activities, I'm happy to report that we continue to recharge water from Metropolitan. We have 30 CFS of water going in the ground right now. We've already recharged all of the Saboba settlement water for the year 2019. So we completed the 2019 recharge. We are now moving into 2020 pre-deliveries with Metropolitan. We've delivered 472 acre feet of the 7,500, so we're putting that water in the ground at a very good pace. We think the 2020 water would be in the ground completely by this fall. City of Hemet, as well as Lake Hemet Municipal Water District, have confirmed that they will want to pay for that water now, up front, the pre-delivered water. Again, the advantage of paying for the pre-delivered water now is we get it at this year's rate. So next year, Metropolitan's rates will increase approximately 4%. We forego that rate increase if we buy the pre-delivered water now. City of San Jacinto is still considering that. There's a meeting with the senior management at the City of San Jacinto tomorrow in which we're going to go over a couple of options that we came up. But they want to see the water get in the ground, but it's the timing and the payment that they're concerned about. It's good news in terms of replenishment. Work is, I'm happy to report, underway for those additional septic sewer conversions that we're doing in Quail Valley, Subarea 9, with the money, grant money that was available from the project coming in under budget. That additional extension, if you recall, is on La Cresta Avenue and will serve 16 parcels. We are underway in doing the construction as we speak. Unfortunately, there was a construction accident out there earlier in the week involving down in construction where an individual was caught between two pieces of heavy equipment. He did survive and is undergoing surgery right now. So that's put a little bit of hiccup in the schedule, but we still believe that the property, the sewer will be installed and the property is connected within 30 days. We do have access agreements for all except for one parcel. The other parcel is an out-of-area owner, and we'll continue to work with them on that. On legislative activities to fund the safe drinking water for disadvantaged communities and governance, I'm very happy to report that our co-sponsored legislation was passed off the Senate floor on a unanimous 37-0 vote ahead of the May 31st deadline, so we now go over to the Assembly. We have not had our policy committee hearings scheduled yet, but we anticipate to hear that schedule later on this week. or early next week. On the funding side, it's also getting very interesting right now. The Senate had advanced a package of bills, including SB 414, the district's bills for governance, but also modified the Monning bill from Senator Monning, SB 200, which you recall last year Senator Monning was the senator who was proposing the water tax. That's no longer in his bill. What is in his bill is $150 million annual appropriation that would come from the general fund from various funding sources. So the Senate has advanced that as a package. The Assembly has also advanced a bill, AB 217, by Assemblymember Eduardo Garcia. And that includes a tax on water and the agricultural fees, much like the Monning bill and the governor's proposal. However, and kind of an interesting side note, what they did not include in that bill was the regulatory relief that the ag community would receive from the contributions to as mitigation. And so the agricultural community is now in opposition to that bill. Because they have budget implications, the Senate and the Assembly have formed a budget conference committee to conference this and a whole variety of other budget topics. That conference committee started meeting last Thursday. Two members of the conference committee are from Eastern Service Area, Assemblymember Mays and Senator Roth. So we have reached out to them, and thank you, Director Record, for helping us with that to kind of get the message across of where we are with respect to supporting the Senate's version of the package without the water tax. Those conference, that conference committee activities are ongoing into next week. So a lot of exciting things. One of the things that was really notable from yesterday in the media was the Sacramento Bee, who has steadfastly endorsed a water tax, put together a editorial yesterday endorsing the Senate's funding package without the water tax. So I think that's very significant, basically saying let's move on with this. And so we're really pleased to see that moving forward. And I did provide the link in the report in case you want to look at that. Finally, I want to bring up an issue we're dealing with right now with respect to the Paris Valley biofilter and the Paris Valley plant. If you've known during certain times we have some odors that are coming from the plant, that's not typically what we've experienced in the plant in the past. If you'll recall, we have a foul air handling system that uses a biological filter that has wood chips in it, and then grows a biological media that removes the odors. Those wood chips, which we replaced a few years ago, have decomposed prematurely, and so we're seeing some areas of drop performance on that media, and because of that decomposition. So we have some occasional odors around the facility. So I've asked staff to, and they've done a great job going back and saying, okay, let's rethink this whole system and what could we do to ensure more long-term performance. And they've come up with a great course of action that will involve changing the wood chip media to a synthetic media that will last a very long time. But to go to that synthetic media, we're going to need to make some modifications to the biofilters themselves because we have a greater media depth and we have potential changes in the foul air handling blowers, the plenum and the laterals. And so we are contracting with an engineering firm to design those and hope to have this out to bid for reconstruction in December of this year. So I just want to give the board an update on that because that is a change that's coming down the tracks. So with that, are there any questions or comments?
Any questions?
On the last item, so what do we do in the meantime between now and December or now and next year?
Well, we're going to continue, obviously, to monitor that. Matt, do you have anything you want to add on that?
I have a phone call right after this meeting to go over some other options, but some of the other thoughts are to continue with some of the sewer cleaning projects immediately around the plant that we've been working on. We're getting some misters put in place so we can put some really would mask the odors, but some other fragrances in the finesse line that we can spray, and then maybe some other chemical addition in the plant. But we are considering several options to get through in the short term.
kind of bridges through.
Thank you, Matt.
Very much. I appreciate that. May I answer your question?
Yes, sir. Awesome.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Okay. Laura.
Nothing, Bill.
Nothing additional today.
Nothing. Joe.
Good morning, Mr. President. This is a couple of quick updates. We have been engaged with PGA to reach out to the community and send something regarding our well drilling activities, and specifically for well 203. We commenced drilling the pilot core on May 28th. We were anticipating that 24-hour operation would require up to 3 weeks. I'm happy to report that we completed the pilot bore as of this Monday, a couple of weeks ahead of schedule. This week we are receiving materials. We will reinitiate 24-hour operation for the reaming of the well. That will start sometime next week. So far, we're pleased to report that we're ahead of schedule. We continue to update the community on our progress. Second item, I just wanted to introduce to you a new staff member who you'll probably be seeing on a regular basis, Joe Brohead. Joined us recently. He is our senior, or I should say principal water resource specialist in charge of CEQA and NEPA activities. He'll be supporting Al. He comes to us with extensive experience in environmental regulatory compliance, especially experience with Indian tribes. And he has done extensive work with the Soboka tribe as well. That's all.
And he went through the high five line this morning.
Okay, with that, we'll go to the consent calendar, and we have a request to pull D and E. Any others? Okay, with that, we'll accept a motion to accept.
Move the consent calendar.
With the exception of D and E.
Second.
They're moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, it's been brought to my attention by Director Cronin that there may be a potential conflict as to items D and E for Director Cronin. So my recommendation would be to have Director Cronin leave the dais, and then the board can act on the remaining items.
Yes, I have a conflict of interest on D and E because my family does business with Krieger and Stewart, so I'm going to step off.
Okay, noting that Director Corona has left the dais in the room, can we have a motion to accept D and E?
I'll move that we approve items D and E on the consent calendar.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries unanimously with Director Corona absent. Or out of the room.
Okay.
With that, we'll go to agenda item 5A, which is to adopt the 2019-2021 strategic plan and strategic priorities.
If you weren't already tired of hearing my voice today, we have another item that I will be covering, and I'm really pleased to bring forward the Triennial Strategic Plan for 2019 to 2021. In your package, we have two items. One is the strategic planning document itself, which has been provided. And as a companion to the strategic plan, we put together a very detailed list of strategic priorities for all the initiatives that are listed in the strategic plan. That's this document, which really outlines the description of those very specific projects, what the updates and activities are, the target completion dates, and the responsible executive for those projects. So I will be referring to those intermittently through the presentation. This was really, I thought, a very positive multi-step process involving the board of directors, of course, but really all levels of the organization. We had workshops with our entire staff on this, with our management team, supervisors and above, and of course, two workshops with the board. And in starting out, one of the things we did was really looked at the format of the previous strategic plan and see if we needed to make any very significant changes to that format.
That format included a mission, vision, guiding principles, standards of excellence, and then outlining what our strategic priorities are. We also, of course, talked about industry game changers. I'll speak to that in a moment. And really updated language in the document to provide current relevant clarifications. But I think the important conclusion was the structure of that strategic plan worked very well in the previous 3 years, and so we wanted to continue that on a going forward basis. So as you'll recall, the strategic plan, which was adopted in 2016 through 18, had 56 initial projects identified in the strategic plan. 12 projects were added in 2017, 9 were added in 2018. So we had a total of 77, what we call action items, project programs, etc. Most of those, or many of them, are multi-year efforts. We did, however, have successful completion of 49 of those 76 that were listed, with the remaining being carryover projects. So in the 2019 to 2021 triennial strategic plan, we will have 28 projects carrying over. And then, as I'll go through in a moment, we have additional projects that are listed. And again, those are included in this Exhibit B to the strategic planning document. So as we did in our last strategic planning cycle, we started out with saying, what are the big industry game changers that we're seeing? And I think we had contributions on this list from our management team, from the board, and from individual staff members as we did the workshops. And they really come down to the seven that are listed here, dealing with the current political changes that we're seeing in the division among state and federal government, the rapid changes we see in the workforce right now, climate variation and the need to have a plan to address climate variation, customer demand to easy and access to easy, diverse technology, imported water uncertainty associated with California water fix, and then the trend towards water agency consolidation and privatization, and of course, cyber and physical security. So we have incorporated in the strategic priority specific projects to address these industry game changers. So let's start out with the basic foundational statements of any strategic plan, mission, vision, and guiding principles. So for the mission statement, what we ended up with through the board's input and that of staff and others is to deliver value by diverse customers and communities we serve by providing safe, reliable, economical, and environmentally sustainable water, wastewater, and recycled water services. And then on the vision statement, to provide exceptional level of customer and community service, seeing the performance of any public or private entities. We felt that this was a very strong mission and vision statement, and we did make some amendments to it, but we're including it as written here. Going on to the guiding principles, what the guiding principles are, and you hear this on other strategic plans, is kind of really what the core values are for the organization. They really define how we conduct ourselves as a group, on how we conduct our business. So we have guiding principles in the areas of community, innovation, integrity, leadership, also respect, responsibility, safety, of course, which is principal to this agency, and transparency. So that really outlines the guiding principles, the mission, and the vision. Any questions on those portions of the strategic plan before we get kind of into the core? Any questions? Okay, so I'll continue. The core of the strategic plan is defined by really the strategic priorities at the top of the pyramid there. And what we have in this strategic plan is an organization statement that we're organized by the standards of excellence. That's included in this statement. And essentially, it's to provide safe, reliable, economical, and environmentally sustainable services. And then those are clearly defined through the following strategic priorities. So these seven core categories, really, if you think about what we do as an organization, everyone in the organization does something that falls under one of these seven categories. And so that's really how the document is organized around these. And so I'll go through these in some of the areas that we've added specific projects and priorities. First and foremost is our core business, reliable water, wastewater, recycled water service. Just as some highlights,
Our Brad Coffey was here from Metropolitan. One of the things we're going to see coming up in the next 2 years is Met is going to be upgrading its integrated resources plan. That's included in there. Also, the landscape and cultural transformation that we're undergoing with our non-functional turf removal initiative. And so those are embodied in this very core, basic strategic priority of reliable water, wastewater, and recycled water services. The next is the protection of public and environmental health. Again, these shows what are included in the document in detail. I do want to point out we did add under one strategic priority, climate action plan. Climate action plan is a nomenclature that's used for a document that looks at the effect of the changing climate. It's also a document that really needs to be put together these days to accompany a lot of grant applications. And so it's one of the things we really need to undertake as an organization. Under customer service, there's a number of new initiatives here. Under awareness, the biannual customer survey we're doing to basically get feedback from the customers that we can use to retool the services that we provide. One of the things we've talked about at this district several times is SB 998. This is the new shutoff requirements and work that we're doing there to implement that. And then under technology, the CIS replacement is listed. That's a carryover project. This is also where we're going to look at building on the CIS replacement in the future in the latter part of the strategic planning period to provide our customer 24/7 access portal to water data. But we're also adding priorities in terms of secure email billing platform and recycled water customer portal. Under sound planning and efficiency, quite a big list under this category that we do have a couple of highlights to this. We've added six new items on this, organized under operational efficiency, energy independence, groundwater management, administration technology, and maintenance. We have a number of technology applications that we're working on. One of the things I want to bring to your attention we are going to focus on and continue is, and really almost relates to our previous presentation, is our emergency operations response program. We periodically conduct emergency operation exercises with scenarios of system outages or other disasters. We want to continue to work on those with other agencies. And so those are some among some of the things that we're focusing on under operational efficiencies. Fiscal responsibility and appropriate investment. One of the things I'd like to highlight on this, we have two new items. One is the infrastructure replacement and refurbishment model. We need to get that updated, look at how much we need to be putting aside in terms of a replacement reserve, what the future rate implications as we see our infrastructure age. And another is a study to really look at our fee for services and how we provide those and better serve the development community in terms of inputting in deposits and how we use those. And so kind of that whole fee for service, we want to take a look at that and update that. Also, on being an exemplary employer, we do have in 2019 our labor negotiations that will be completed by the end of the calendar year, so we'll have a new labor MOU. And one of the things that we talked about fairly extensively in the Game Changers was the changing workforce. And what are we doing on that? We do have a succession plan included in the document already. We now have added an item on work environment modernization plan. This is to look at everything from the workspace modernization to flexible work arrangement policies, career development incentives for multi-generational employees, etc. So it's something we're focusing on and aware of, that our workforce is really changing. And I think we saw that this morning with all the new employees, and we realize we're having a lot of turnover because of retirement. A lot of old guys like myself are getting to that age, and we're seeing a flood of new employees. And we're not alone in this. The entire industry is. But we want to make sure we're recruiting the best and really providing a work environment that recruits the best. Under effective communication, advocacy, and community partnerships, a couple of things here, an outreach and communications master plan. Again, this looks at that immediate access to information, making sure we're really getting out what we need to our entire community and the diverse community in our service area. We're going to be refreshing our branding.
and also looking at publishing an electronic annual report. We're ramping up and retooling our California WaterFix support now that that project is being redefined by the new Newsom administration. So with that, we'd ask that the board consider adopting the strategic plan and approving the strategic priorities. And also, I'd like to thank the board for your assistance in putting that document together. I think it really provides us a great roadmap for the next few years. So are there any questions I could answer?
Any questions? If not, we'll entertain a motion in a second.
I'd move approval.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries unanimously.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. With that, we will go to 6B, approve and authorize an award of contract with Don Peterson Incorporated for $521,250 under specification number 362S. San Jacinto Valley Regional Water Reclamation Facility Screw Conveyor and additional appropriation of $740,200. Joe.
Good morning again. We have a need to replace a component of our biosolids water system at the San Jacinto Reclamation Plant. This is part of our capital improvement program. I wanted to quickly cover a little bit of background on the project, summary of the construction bids we received, then the scope of work as well as schedule and our recommendation. So at the San Jacinto plant, dewatering building, we have belt conveyors that are shown here. And there are three sections to convey the dewatered biosolids up to the storage hopper. These conveyors have been in service for over 30 years. They have reached the end of useful life. We examined the technology and we have decided to migrate to a screw conveyor technology, which is quite distinctive in that it offers a number of advantages. One is it's fully enclosed, thus there's less potential for material to spill over, thus less labor to clean up the building on a daily basis. But also there's obviously less emissions, which means less corrosion potential for the building system. This is a picture of the screw conveyor equipment that was installed back in 2016 over at the Moreno Valley Reclamation Plant. As you'll see here, it is fully enclosed. The foul air is evacuated through these ducts and treated. Thus, everything is contained within the system. As part of the scope of work for the contractor, they will purchase the equipment, install it. There's also electrical improvements that have to be implemented to support the equipment. And, of course, coordination with the plant staff and MATS forces to accomplish the implementation. And then, ultimately, once the new system is up and running, we've got to remove and demolish the old system as well. We completed the design, advertised the project for bid. We did receive three bids. The lowest bidder was, or is, Don Peterson, who we've worked with extensively in the past. They've done great work for us. I should note that the bids received were within a spread of 10%, which indicates to us that there was clarity in the bid documents. The low bid was approximately 7% above the engineer's estimate. So upon the board approval of this item, we will issue a notice to proceed to the contractor this month. We anticipate we'll complete construction by March of next year. So our recommendation is to award a construction contract with Don Peterson in the amount of $521,000 and the administrative award and execution of other consultant support services during construction and the necessary appropriation to complete this effort. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
So does this put all four of our wastewater facilities on this new technology then?
I believe so. I want to check with Matt. Did we have spoken with this conversion? Do we have any remaining belt conveyors?
You know, I have to go check, but I think this should be it.
Okay. As they reach end of useful life, yeah. We want to replace them with the upgraded technology, but I believe this is the last one.
Okay.
I think it is.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Move approval.
Seconded.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries unanimously. With that, we'll go to item C, which is approve and authorize award of contract with Big Sky Electric Incorporated for $2,040,400 under specification number 151-3595 Moreno Valley Regional Water Reclamation Facility Tertiary Effluent Pump Station and Motor Control Center's replacement project, and additional appropriation of $2,934,870.
We're going to have a longer title for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Eric, time to come up to the podium.
Yeah.
That was a short version.
Good morning. This is about the Moreno Valley RWR taps and Motor Control Center replacement associated with that. Presentation includes some background information, the scope of work for professional services to support the construction contract. Summary bids for the received from the construction project bid advertising process. And recognition board, as part of background, I'm going to focus on the photograph that's on this sheet. And it shows the inside of the older TEPS electrical building, and there are MCCs on the left and the right side of the two gentlemen in that photograph. That equipment services the Landmark and Paris Valley line restocked water service areas in the 1627 zone and the pumps connected to these MCCs, as well as the plant utility board. This is a critical function for the Moreno Valley site, and the original installation of these MCCs was around the early 1990s. They were upgraded around 2005 to incorporate some soft starts. Between 2010 and 2012, there were two new large pumps added to this pump station. And as you can see by this photograph, there was no room in this existing TEPS building to incorporate that, so a new electrical building was constructed at that point in time. But the major point is that most of this equipment that you see in this photograph was installed around the early 1990s, and it's reached the end of its useful life, and it's very difficult to get replacement parts for this equipment. The photograph on the right on this presentation slide shows the outside of the MCC building. That MCC building, you see the pumps that are directly outside of the building. And then below the building, you can see a call out to the TEPS wet well. And that's kind of a poor location for an MCC building. We get moisture and vapor from the wet well that leads to corrosion inside the MCC room. You can see the photo on the left, you see some visible corrosion of a pipe stain that's sitting in that room. But if you were to open up those cabinets, you would look at IO cabinet, IO contact points that are severely corroded. There's a lot of elements that are corroded inside the cabinets as well.
So you can show on this picture, I think it's interesting, the building literally, it looks like it's next to it, but it's actually on top of the wet well, literally, or just right next to it, right by the wet well, almost sharing the same foundation. Is that correct, Eric?
That's correct.
You see on the right there, yeah. So you get all the vapors come up, and that's been the corrosion.
Sure, let me get that off.
Yes, hit escape.
Thank you very much. I am a little off. And that focus was for me. Continue with the discussion of the photos and the discussion of the old NCC 10 and 10MA. If you look at the photo of the two circles on it, the building on the right is the TEPS wet well, which has the old NCC. As I mentioned prior in the prior slide, that there was a new building constructed, and that's the circle on the left. And as part of this project, we're going to not only replace this old electrical gear, we're going to actually relocate it into the newer electrical building. And you can see the photo on the very bottom in the center, that's a visual of the new electrical building. That's plenty of space in it. That's going to be a better environment for this gear, as well as going to make the construction a lot easier. In other words, these are very critical pumps that cannot be shut down for a very long period of time. We'll be able to install the new gear in the new electrical building, provide conductors over to the pumps and control signals over the pumps to be able to swap them out sequentially, keeping the TEPS system in operation. And so this plan is actually making the construction of that project far easier than trying to just remove all that equipment and then try to replace it in the same place. With regards to advertisement of the project, we advertised on April 4th. We received three bids on May 9th. Big Sky Electric Incorporated provided the lowest responsive bid in the amount of $2,040,400. The engineer's estimate was $2,557,400. As you can see, the three bids are fairly tight in range. I think the contractors viewed the project similarly. One bid was deemed unresponsive, and but still, I think this is a good representative bid for the state.
Pedro Sawyer performed the design for this project. They were selected on a competitive bid process. They have done an excellent job on the design and been very supportive during this process. And they have given us a scope of work for services during construction, including engineering field support, submittal reviews, responses to clarifications, typical services that we provide during construction by the engineer. Again, they've done an excellent job, and they were competitively selected for the design for this project. The schedule, final design is complete. Award for consideration of the construction contract is today. Obviously, we would like to start that contract as soon as possible in June, and substantial completion is estimated to be in August of 2020. Recommendation to the board for consideration is award of construction contract for Big Sky Electric in the amount of $2,040,400. Execution of the engineering service contract for Pacer Sawyer in the amount of $94,230. An administrative award of necessary contracts to complete the project during construction. The appropriation request at this time is $2,934,870, bringing the total construction project level cost to $3,233,152. If there's any questions at this point in time.
Board, have any questions?
No. I'll move the item.
1 second.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Let's take a 10-minute break.